Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is music director, keyboard player, and producer Rob Schrock-Barry, who many of you know as Rob Schrock. But first, I want to talk about Quick Hits. And this is a radio format that's only come to my attention just now, even though it's been around for a couple of years. So what is Quick Hits? Quick Hits edits the songs on a radio playlist, so the song is about half as long to maybe two-thirds as long. The idea is they want to get a lot more songs in the playlist per hour. So in other words, what they want to do is get 24 songs in the playlist for an hour, which is quite a bit more. What's interesting is their logo is twice the music in half the time. Actually, radio's been trying to do this for quite a while, and they started by speeding up songs. Usually what you hear on the radio is sped up by 2%, something like that, a little less sometimes, but it's sped up so they can get more songs playing within the hour. The idea is, if you get more songs, that means there's more of a chance that someone will hear what they like, so they'll stay with the station and they won't turn away. So if a song is only 2 minutes long, for instance, or a minute and a half, that means by the time they decide that they're going to change the station, they're onto another song, and maybe that will keep them from changing the station. So a lot of people are up in arms about this, and it's mostly artists, actually. Most artists are saying, this is changing my art. Well, yes, it is to a degree, because it's getting rid of things like solos and breakdowns and sometimes even bridges. But you know what? This has actually been going on almost since the beginning of radio and records, in that there's always been radio edits, always. For any kind of hit, there's always been a radio edit, so it will fit within a format. And usually they figured it was somewhere around 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and that's gone up and down a little bit over the years. But the fact of the matter is, radio wants more songs per hour. And for the most part, the audiences really like it. Because if you look at the comments, most of the negative ones come from artists, and they don't come from the listeners. This really hasn't spread too much. It's in Canada, and it's in a few stations in the Midwest. But the next time you're listening to a station that seems to be playing a whole lot of songs, and the song seems shorter, you're listening to Quick Hits. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's called 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. The next thing I'd like to talk about are the six things that I bring to every session. Now, believe it or not, this isn't gear. These are things to make me comfortable, personally comfortable, in the studio. And the main thing I bring to make myself comfortable is a flannel shirt or a hoodie. And the reason why is at studios, the air conditioning is blasting. It can be really cold. So you find that the temperature has wide extremes. 1 minute you're too cold, the next minute you may be too warm. So what I like to do is I always pack a flannel shirt, I always pack a hoodie maybe, so I know that no matter what, I'm not going to get cold, because that bothers me more than anything in the studio. So I like to stay warm. So that's the first thing I always bring, is a flannel shirt or a hoodie. The second thing is comfy shoes, because you're probably going to be on your feet for a long time. Now, I personally can't wear sneakers. And the reason why is they hurt my feet. And when that happens, my ankles hurt, and so do my knees especially. So instead, I wear a walking shoe that's by Merrell walking shoes. I find that they conform to my feet. I never have to think about it. It always feels good. There's never a problem. But no matter what, you should always bring your favorite shoes, because you're going to be on your feet for a long period of time, so you might as well be comfortable. The third thing I always bring are some beverages. Now, yes, in many high-end studios, there's plenty of beverages. There's usually not what I want, though. I like iced tea, and usually you won't find a lot of iced tea. And when you do find it, it's sweetened, and I prefer unsweetened iced tea. So I'll bring iced tea, or I'll bring Gatorade. Again, another item that you can't find. In many of the smaller studios, there's not even water, so you want to bring bottled water or whatever. But that's one thing you should always have in your list, to bring some beverages, because you're going to get thirsty. Another thing that I'd never go to a session without are earplugs. The reason why, you're going to go out in the studio, and someone's going to be blasting. There's going to be a guitar that's going to be turned up. There's going to be a drummer that's going to be a heavy hitter that's really banging it out. So what I do is I always bring my trusty earplugs, and these are Etymotic Research ER20s. They're the best $12 you can ever spend. These things are scientifically designed to just cut the level down and not affect the frequency response. So you can actually put these in your ears and kind of forget them. And I've done that for many sessions where I have in my ears when I go out into the studio when a drummer is playing on placing mics, and I come back and I kind of forget about it. Or the other time I keep them in is when an artist or record label or friends come in and they want you to crank it up. That might hurt your ears, or you might get fatigued. So I make sure I have the earplugs in at that point in time. But for $12, Etymotic Research ER20s, you can't go wrong. And even if you don't use the Etymotics, just bring some earplugs because you'll always be happy that you have them. Another thing I always bring is a camera. Now, I do this less often because we all have cell phones that have great cameras in them. But the thing about it is, you always want to document what you're doing. You want to document any kind of setups. You want to document anything in a console, for instance, or outboard gear. Or you just want to document the people in the room that are playing that you're working with. And you'd be surprised the number of times these come in handy. If for no other reason than 5 years, 10 years down the road, you want to look back and remember the session, at least you have some pictures. So always bring some sort of a camera with you and make sure you use it. The other thing I always bring is a laptop or a tablet, because there may be long periods when nothing happens. Usually if you're engineering, that's not the case, but there still may be times when, for instance, you're waiting on someone and there's nothing to do in the meantime, so you have a long period of time. So I want to go online, I want to search for some things, I want to check email. So it's always nice to have a laptop, and more I'm bringing a tablet instead. Finally, the last thing is a flashlight to bring, because you never know when you're going to be behind a rack looking to plug something in, or you'll be behind an amplifier or in some sort of dark place. And it's always nice to have that flashlight. What I really like is something called Blocklight, and this is really ingenious. It's a 6-LED section that fits on top of a 9-volt battery. It's really small, it's really brilliant, it's bright enough, and it's small because it's basically the size of the 9-volt battery and a little more. So those are the things that I always bring with me to a session, and I always find that I use them most of the time. My guest today is Rob Schrock-Barry, who many of you know as Rob Schrock, who's played with the score of hitmakers including Adele, Elton John, Elvis Costello, Stevie Wonder, Garth Brooks, Rumour, and Gloria Estefan. Rob is also the music director for Burt Bacharach and Dionne Warwick, and was one of the music directors for the 72nd Academy Awards show. He's also written for Keyboard, Mix, Remix, and Electronic Musician magazines. I spoke with Rob via Skype from a studio in Arkansas. From what I can tell, you're a very educated musician. Like, you spent a lot of time when you're a kid playing, lessons, the whole thing. Tell me about all that. How did you get started?
I actually started quite late. I think maybe 14 or 15 is when I started playing piano. I played a little trumpet in band before that, around fifth grade or so. But when I moved into piano, I did progress along pretty quickly, and had a really fantastic piano teacher, Marjorie Bond. She was just a world-class teacher, fourth generation Chopin. So her teacher's teacher was Chopin. And so she instilled a lot of great work practices in me fairly early. And I carried on with that, graduated high school and went on, did a little bit of university, but went straight to California and kind of fell right into working out there. And it wasn't too long after that, I kind of fell in with the Motown camp, and that fell into a little bit of Stevie Wonder, right into Dionne Warwick and into Burt Bacharach. So kind of really on early on, by late teens, I was already pretty in deep. And so I think a lot of that early background for those 3 or 4 years of study really helped put all that in a good place for what was in store for me. And then I think being with someone like Burt Bacharach or Dionne Warwick early on, that instills a lot, and you're learning constantly on stage. And I would actually get in the studio with them as well. And so it was just a big learning thing. I think I was really fortunate to young been kind of just dropped into the deep end of the pool, and you sink or swim.
Gee, I mean, such legends between Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach. It's amazing. So you were still in your teens when you were working with them?
I think late teens, yeah. So it would have been mid 80s.
Wow.
And they were just coming off, right around That's What Friends Are For. So it was just a big, high profile time for both of them. And Burt and I connected musically kind of immediately. We really had a good musical connection. And I was all that time on stage with him sitting 6 feet away, so I really could kind of see his hands. So there was so much you learn, but just you're absorbing it all the time. So even everything I do now as an adult still kind of is informed by that aesthetic of songwriting and arrangement, phrasing with Dionne as a singer. It just kind of really has informed everything that I do these days.
Were you kind of aware of, and a lot of us when we're young, we don't quite grasp the situation that we're in a lot of times. Did you, with them?
I have to say, I'm a little more in awe now when I look back on it than at the time. I think at the time you're just in the middle of your doing it. And I was somewhat familiar with the catalog because when I started teaching myself piano as a kid, my grandmother had like a Reader's Digest book of best love songs, and there were some Bacharach songs in there. So I remember kind of teaching myself some of that then. So I thought, wow, this is cool. I'm playing Close to You or Raindrops with the guy.
Yeah.
As you become older, you learn more and more of the catalog and the depth of what they were actually doing. And that's when you almost can kind of go, oh my gosh, I should be in awe. But if there's this, when you're with that personal relationship with them, it's just a people thing that's happening and sharing the same struggles of trying to get sound check to go well or trying to get, trying to capture a recording, the struggle of that. So when you're in it, it just seems like what you're doing.
Yeah.
And as I'm branching off doing more and more stuff, I do reflect back on that and go, God, I was kind of a knucklehead for not fully appreciating at the time, what I was surrounded by. But you're absorbing as a kid, and it's all exciting. It's just what you're doing. Everything you're doing is exciting. Every crappy band I was also doing at the time or demo or song I was writing, I thought was equally as exciting. So it's all just kind of what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
And it's good to have that enthusiasm for it. And then later you can look back and go, that was fantastic. That was crap. And yeah, it's hindsight.
Yeah, I know. I had much the same type of experience, many experiences. When I first moved to California, I'd meet these people that were real heavies, and it took a long time until it really sunk in. For instance, I remember going to Gold Star when Gold Star Recording was still around, and having Dave Gold take me around, take me into the original room where they did all Spector's Wall of Sound and everything, and it never really hit me what was going on. It was kind of like, oh, this is old stuff, And I look back on it now and I go, wow, I wish I would have really paid more attention when I was there.
It's hard because when you're in the moment, you really are doing the task at hand. And I've been fortunate enough to work with a bunch of legends. And when you kind of fall in these conversations, you realize even with them, they're just doing the work. They don't even know until kind of after the fact that was really brilliant. And that wasn't so great. And all that kind of realization kind of comes after. You're really kind of caught in the moment of doing. And I think, and that's a beautiful way, I think, to create art. I don't know. Maybe somebody really feels a couple times in their lives, oh my God, this is really, I'm making something really masterful. I think you just kind of go about the job and focus on what you have to. I remember on this last Rumor record last year, we mixed that with Michael Brower at Electric Lady. And as much as the engineer part of me is really interested in his multi-layered compression techniques and all that we read about, I couldn't be bothered with it in the moment. At that point, I'm in a producer chair. I'm trying to get mixes. I don't care what he's doing.
Yeah,
that sounds right. That doesn't. So I look back on it, and I remember after he came off the mixes, like, oh, I should have picked his brain a little more about that. We had a two-minute conversation about it, and I glazed over because your head's in a different place. And I think so much of what we do has two stages, and that's the what you're doing in the moment, which is the important thing, and then the reflection part, I think, and they're both equally valid because reflecting on what you've done in your process will inform the next thing, but it's hard to do that in the moment, and I think that applies to all of us. But for me, certainly, as I've been working with these people. You're just in that moment trying to create something really good.
Yeah, yeah, right. Now, I have this in much the same experience. I can't engineer and produce at the same time. I'm, you know, many people can do it. I can't. So I usually try to hire, you know, a great engineer to track for me. And I had Ken Scott on one project. And it was the same thing where I wish I could have paid more attention. And I, you know, I did a little bit because I understood, you know, where he's coming from and, you know, his legend and all, but, you know, you have to, you're in the moment and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And, you know, you have those blinders on, which is what you're supposed to do.
And that, yeah, that is the professionalism part of covering your chair, because all that responsibility is there. And if somebody wants to go move a mic an inch or so, have at it. I'm just trying to keep the big picture thing in mind. So it's great, because I think guys like us get to be in all those chairs at different times, and we can address these issues in different ways. Sometimes it's as the arranger, you're trying to fix problems by, you know, the strings go high here, and then you know, take out all the rhythm guitars here at this point, whether it's, you know, in the moment on the session or later when you've got all the faders up in front of you. Sometimes it's fixing the problem that way. Sometimes it's like all the beautiful techniques you're showing in your series. Sometimes it's a bit of parallel compression and an EQ move, and it's these things solving problems that way. And then sometimes it really is sitting back and just going with the spirit of it, which is that doesn't feel right and someone else is in that chair and, you know, it needs to be a little more blue. And sometimes that is an equally valid way to approach these things. And it is difficult to do these things simultaneously, but I think it is good to be able to do all those different things at different times.
Yeah, I agree. And we have to anymore. The days of just being, I think, an arranger or a producer, an engineer or, you know, whatever, a keyboard player, I think those days are over where we all have to be multifaceted. It's just the nature of the business anymore. Maybe it always was, really.
I think a lot of us that got early on into the digital workstations and the ADATs and the home recording thing, even though maybe it wasn't fully up to snuff at the time, we're the ones now, I think, that really have kind of inherited this business because of that same reason. Yeah. Not only does the technology allow us to do all these things, but the economics of the business almost require us to.
Yeah.
So those of us that have invested in being a jack of all trades, I think the world is really ours to just continue. We need, you know, obviously need to improve all of our techniques in all these areas as we go. But it really is our world to do with how we see fit.
You know, I want to back up for a second. You said that you moved here. Where did you grow up? You grew up outside of California, I get. So where was that?
As a kid, I grew up in Arkansas. And then from Arkansas, I went straight to California, and it was a lot of years out there. But I've always had this ambivalence with Los Angeles. I love it. And then sometimes it really gets to me. And so I've always done this thing where I'll be in California for 8 or 9 years, and then I'll run to Memphis for a year or two, and then I'll come back, and then I'll go to Texas, and then I'll come back, and I'll go to Portland, and then I'll come back. And so right now, Rumor and I just got married a couple of months ago, we spent some of our time in London. We did 6 months there during her last record. And we keep a place in Los Angeles. And also we bought a house in Northwest Arkansas close to my parents and put in a studio here. So that gives us the ability to kind of be where we need to, but also kind of get a little quiet and a little peace when we need to hunker in to focus, which is kind of what we're doing now. Yeah. So I'm talking to you from Arkansas right now.
Got it. Okay, so when you first moved to Los Angeles, did you know anybody? Did you have any ins in the business?
Not at all.
So what happened? How did you do it? Because a lot of people can't make that jump.
Well, you know, nobody can ever repeat anybody else's path, but I can share anyway for whatever interest it may be. So went out there and immediately dove in, got a job in a bank as a teller, because just you have to make a little money. But immediately started going around. I joined a band pretty soon out there. This was back when the hair metal thing was going on. And so all the bands were playing. Back in the day, it was Wong's West and FM Station and the Country Club and all those places in the Valley and in Hollywood. I was doing that, and then also taking around song demos, trying to get that going, jumping into some recording studios. So very, very early on, Vinnie Medina and Carrie Ashby, which is one of Barry Gordy's sons, were running Jobet Publishing. There was Hitsville down there. I just kind of got to know some people there and started writing and working out of there. That led to a small little stint of working at Stevie Wonder's studio. DX7's had just come out, and I took a DX7 class with Clark Spangler, one of the guys that helped design that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I kind of knew my way around that, and there weren't very many, and I think when that kind of made his radar, so I'll bring that thing on down. And so I spent a few months there programming, because I could get around on the thing, and basically just coming up with sounds that he could then come through and listen to. And I think someone in that camp is what referred me to Dion when she was looking for a new keyboard player. At the same time, I had started learning engineering. There was a studio up in the valley, and the owner of that had already kind of noticed, I think I'd gone and done some sessions there or something, had noticed my sort of playing and arranging skills. Drum machines were coming out and everything. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll teach you engineering if you will kind of in trade use your skills, because everybody, songwriters in the day, still had to come in and pay for demos. And so it was a little, he had a 24-track room and a little 8-track room. And the 8-track room sort of was a songwriter thing. People would come in and have a Lindrum and a little Prophet and a couple of keyboards and play a little guitar and bass and produce out these demos. And so it was really good for me getting to learn the songwriting game, the arranging game, the recording. And he was really great, very methodical. So he was taught me engineering. And, you know, a year or two later, I'm aligning 24-track machines and cutting tape and really just, again, kind of dove right in head first. At the same thing, the bank job obviously didn't last very long, but because now we're moving and going. So it's playing in bands, it's doing the hanging down late nights at Hitsville, learning from those songwriters there, also doing the same thing, working in this studio, just bouncing around doing all that. And then pretty quickly, that's when it fell into, you want to do these shows with Dionne Warwick. And, okay, great, I learned the songs, showed up for the rehearsal. I thought we were doing four shows. I get an itinerary in the mail the next week for like the 150 dates over the next year. And it's like, oh, I guess I'm a touring musician now. And they were just going in not too long after that's when she and Burt Bacharach started touring together and met Burt. And, you know, it really is just one of those stories of being fortunate, being prepared as prepared as possible, and then taking advantage of opportunities as they come your way. And yet, at the same time, I remember some early sessions, because when you come as a kid from a small town, you're a big fish in a small pond, you go out there, you're competing against the best people in the world. I fell flat on my faces on some sessions where I just wasn't versatile enough, exposed enough, didn't quite have the chops. You know, you're learning. And so a lot of people face those things where they get thrown in where it really matters. And even if you sort of fail in that attempt, you have to gut check yourself. Are you going to get better? Are you going to stay in this? Or are you going to pack up and go home?
Yeah.
And I wasn't having any of that. So you just get better and better. But I think we've all had our times where we really have sort of fallen flat and just missed it. So that's part of it, part of this whole process.
Yeah, I don't think you're in this business if that hasn't happened to you at least once. Okay, so I guess then you got your arranging chops from Burt, right?
Obviously, a lot of those techniques came into play later. But when I was – I studied in university for 1 year under a composition teacher named Francis Macbeth, and he was one of the most published band composers at the time. I think ASCAP Award 21 years in a row or something for most published composer. And when I was – leaving university after a year to go west, he actually was really supportive of that and said, well, listen, Rob, if you can read, you can do anything. So here's a couple of my composition books that you would get in your junior year of study. Here are a couple of orchestration books like the Rimsky-Korsakov and a few of these other things. And study scores, and there you go. Because when it comes to composition, you can either write or you can't. So all the other techniques you pick up along the way. So he was actually really influential in setting me on the right path towards arrangement. And I did study a really brief time with Claire Fisher, who was a really fantastic arranger and composer in the Los Angeles area. And his son Brent is actually still a really good friend of mine. So by the time I fell in with Burt and Dion, arranging wasn't brand new to me. I had some basic skill sets already going. Now, that being said, there's nothing like going through a vast amount of material right there in front of you to learn a lot of things. And Bert's instincts, you know, were fantastic. And he's told me on several occasions, and I think he said it to other people as well, it's really hard to separate out his arrangements from the composition because they're conceived at the same time oftentimes. And some of that music doesn't lend itself to over-creative reinventions. A lot of people have redone the Bacharach David catalog in a lot of different ways. And it doesn't always hold up if you try to get too clever with it. And there's something about those arrangements that do seem part of the composition, because most people think of Bacharach very lush, but actually it's very clear in an R&B kind of way, because there's never more than two or three elements going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So it really, it's a puzzle that gets handed around, and you have to understand this about the material. So if you think of, take a song like Walk On By, where the vocal goes, walk on by, bop, 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 trumpet, walk on by. There's foolish pride, that's all strings come in. There's space for all these different things. So it's not the kitchen sink like you might think. And a lot of people want to approach that music. And it's actually a very R&B kind of thing, which is keep the elements focused. Don't overdo it. And let it be really clear what the elements are. So that was the biggest aha moment realization for me coming out of studying classical music, which you can have a lot going on. You can have woodwinds and strings together for a timbre and brass and French horns and percussion together for all these different colors of combinations. And sometimes there's a lot going on and there's a thickness. There's a clarity that I learned in arranging. And I obviously learned that kind of instinctually by just being involved in so much of that music. And then seeing as the new music came along, sometimes it's being a part of that. Going in the studio, I was privileged to be on, you know, several recording dates with him over the years as well, and seeing how that goes. And I'll say one other thing I really learned about him. He is not afraid to take out a pencil and X out a big section.
Wow.
Nope, take that out. Cut, cut, cut. When we wrote... I wrote with him his live show, the one he's even still doing now. But I think we started writing that in 95 and put it on stage in 96. There were times, and basically that process was I would write all the arrangements, and more than adding to that would be cutting things. Mm. That's great. That's great. Now I don't need the woodwinds there. No, yeah, cut that. Cut the low strings. You know, the high line alone will carry it. And these brilliant little tweaks that all of a sudden you go, ah, that sounds like Bert now. And that was a real fantastic process going through that. It was almost the better part of a year of writing that show, because we revisited a lot of his material all the way back from the 60s to the present day, putting that show together. That was really educational.
Boy, I bet. You know, I had a similar experience, maybe not as profound, but it's something that I've always used since then. When I first came to Los Angeles in 1980-81, I was talking to an engineer, David Holman. David was the engineer on all of Olivia Newton-John's hits, and she was huge at the time. And he told me something that's always stuck with me, that's very similar, and it was, there can never be any more than four or five elements happening at the same time in a hit song. And he said, go back and just start to analyze things and you'll find that that's true. And it actually is. It's usually like three, four elements that are happening. And, you know, occasionally you'll have five, and rarely more than that. And apparently what it is there's some psychology going on where your brain gets confused if there's too much going on in an arrangement. And it much prefers.
I completely agree with every bit of that. Even five even sounds like pushing it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I find even today, and, you know, it's one of the things that mixers always face, where especially now, because you can have so many tracks, you usually get them. And the general, because most bands especially, they're not good at arrangement. They're good at conceptualizing things, and they're good at thinking of parts, but they're not good at putting them all together. So when you get something in the mix, consequently, you're taking stuff out all the time. And so then it's always going towards that, okay, three elements, four elements, you know, that type of thing. but it probably doesn't happen to you because I think you're working on a more sophisticated level where the arrangements are so much part of what you're doing and you're thinking of them going in. And again, when you're working with a rock band per se, they don't never necessarily have that level of sophistication, I think.
I think it's always a bit of a struggle trying to find where that line is, because when you're, even if I'm one of the writers on the song, when you're in that creative place, the stuff is coming out. So there's that struggle you have inside yourself to not over edit yourself too much. So you are letting ideas come out, and it takes experience, I think, and maturity to get past the point where you realize not everything is precious and you have to step back a bit. And it's not always easy to cut something that you've come up with, because you feel like you gave birth to that as well. And it does take this other experience side to know that's really great. That part or that element or that idea is great. Let's table it maybe for another song.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you do run the risk of overdoing that as well if you get too vicious with the cuts, and you have to bring things back. So I can't say it's one of those things that you ever get to a point that you glide through it. It's something you're always sort of questioning and feeling. But I think what does happen is over time your instincts will get you there faster. And it is nice if you're working with people who have good musical instincts as well, where you can kind of get to that point. It is difficult when you're working with a young band, and I do work with bands as well, where they are in that place where they feel everything they do is precious and channeled and has to be there, and you have to bring them along. And that, I think that's where we get into the sort of the art of producing, the side of it that's more psychology and more leading rather than dictating. Do you find that challenging?
Yes. Definitely. But, you know, I always have to remind myself of this, but it's their record, and ultimately, and you want it to be as good as possible, but, you know, in the end, it's their record. So I find I'll always acquiesce if they feel strongly enough about something, regardless of how I feel about it. But nonetheless, it's a hard pill to swallow sometimes.
Mm. The things that I love most of any work that I've been involved in are the ones that there was a large collaborative element. The things where I dictated the most or played the most or even did the one-man band thing are the things I'm the least interested in listening to after the fact, because there just isn't that magic of your thing and my thing and then it made this new thing. And I think most of the music that we look back out of the canon of great recordings that we love, most of them have that element of a bit of spontaneity and also a bit of chemistry and alchemy of something that happened that was a little bit out of anyone's control.
Yeah, some push and pull as well. That kind of helps.
I agree.
Tell me about being the MD of the Academy Awards. That sounds like it's a pretty cool gig.
Wow, that was a one-time thing that I never want to do again. And it was 5 years before I was even able to watch the Academy Awards after that.
All right, you got to tell us. Come on.
Okay, there were three of us. There were Burt Bacharach, Don Was, and myself. And there was a big on-camera, I don't know, 15 or 17-minute thing was tribute to Oscar-winning songs. And so the theme of that year was songs, you know, from Oscar-winning movies. Richard and Lily Zanuck were producing the Oscars that year. And I think it's also the longest-running one ever in history. And so that was not good. So Burt quickly decided, well, you know what? I want to do the on-camera part with the all-stars and the band and everything. Rob, you and Don do the pit stuff. So all the rest of the music Don had a band on one side and I had a band on the other. And so the play-ins and play-outs to commercial, a little bit of music during the commercial breaks, entertaining the audiences. So that was all going on.
at the same time. What I learned from that is it was really stressful, and I learned one really valuable lesson from that. When you're leading a band like that, is to don't play also, because I was also playing keyboard along with another keyboard player and then the band.
Because I
was on headset the whole time, so I was having to hear the director giving out lighting cues and camera cues, and this director was really energetic and kind of a screamer. So not only the 4.5 hours of the ceremony where you're trying to hear him play, but you're having to pay attention to what all is in your ear and play. You do a rehearsal the day of the ceremony. You also do a run through, and these run throughs are never on time. So there's 6 hours, and they start that Friday night. So by the time we got down to the ceremony, it had every joke, everything had been rehearsed and done over and over and over. I mean, I was over it, and so I enjoyed it, and it was a great experience. But I realized that's not the career path I want to pursue. This was back in 2000, so I was fairly young. I think I might be the youngest, one of the youngest. Yeah, probably of all the music directors at the Academy Awards, I think I probably was the youngest at the time.
So it was just typical TV craziness.
Yeah. And then, but ambitious, because not only was I leading my band, I was running across under the steps of the stage, playing on some of Don's band stuff, and then was in the band on camera. So when they cut to camera, you know, I do a cutoff and I bolt out to go get on stage with my rig there, four minute commercial break. And we're probably 90 seconds from going live, and they haven't turned my power on yet to my rig. I've got to boot up, and I've got samples to load and all this, and I'm screaming, power, power. Kind of comes up just 2 seconds before, and we're live. And Ray Charles comes out of some, you know, shooting out of some stage right behind my head to do his little bit, and then they take him back in. And Isaac Hayes is on the other side of the stage doing Shaft, and the white smoke that's supposed to cover him in a haze actually just completely engulfs him. You can't even see him. It was hilarious. And then as soon as that's over, and commercial. Now we'll run back down because that's only 2 minutes, and be ready to like hit more downbeats. It was stressful. I have a big tolerance for stress and for pressure. I'm telling you that took me to my limit.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds like it. Jeez. tell me about your cover band AMFM.
Oh, you saw that?
I did. Yes.
We don't play that much anymore because we can't, but it's all LA session musicians and studio musicians. There's myself, there's Ryan Brown, who's now out on tour with Dweezil Zappa. Jason Page, the lead singer, has done backgrounds for Steven Tyler and, you know, duetted with Michael Jackson, and he does a lot of voiceover stuff. Bass player had played with Nancy Sinatra and Jimmy Webb and America, and everybody in the band sings. And so it basically was an excuse to build a cover band that does all the sort of one-hit wonder stuff from the 70s and the FM music that kind of crossed over to AM radio. So it's Boston and Queen and Cheap Trick and Kiss Manfred Mann, and just all the great songs that most cover bands don't play because they're too ambitious. So, you know, Blinded by the Light. And if we, like when we do Queen Bohemian Rhapsody, we actually sing the middle section.
Wow.
You know, even Queen would kind of walk off stage and let a tape play, but we actually would sing that. Wow. Great story. One time we were playing the Viper Room on Halloween, maybe 6-7 years ago. And so we're standing outside the Viper Room, trying to just get our vocals warmed up, and we're running that little "I see a little silhouette" that part.
Yeah.
And CeCe DeVille from Poison wandering down the street. It's like he had a few, and he kind of just sticks his head right in the middle of our circle, and just kind of sticks his head in there, and then we sing that little bit, and we stop, and he goes, "Yeah, man, that's really nice," and then he just goes stumbling off. But no, it's a good fun band. The only problem is everyone is so busy, you know, doing their other professional things that we don't get to play that often. But it's a killer band. It basically was an excuse for me to get to play all the music that I loved when I was in junior high and high school from the 70s and just, you know, take my iPod playlist and put it into a band. But it's good fun.
It's kind of fun when there's no pressure, first of all. And there's no pressure to make any money. There's no pressure to, you know, get a record deal or anything like that and just go play music for fun.
It, you know, that is so true. And that was really the part that it played, because between Dion and Bert and some of the things I'm producing, which tend to kind of fall more on that side of things, this was a chance to just go kind of rock out. I got to play guitar in it and sing. And I tell you, those experiences make you a better musician. I really got, you know, a deeper level understanding of how to sing background vocals really well in a group like that. So you learn simple things like, you know what, less vibrato. Watch your timing. Your timing, your groove as a singer is just as important as your groove as a guitar player or a keyboard player. You have to, you know, your syllables or consonants and these things have to be in time. And so you get that realization. You can sit in your producer chair all day long and tell somebody else when it's right or wrong, but man, get out there and do it for a while and you realize, wow, this is hard. Singing is hard. Singing and playing keyboards and singing backgrounds with a guitar strapped around your neck in 4-inch heels is hard.
You know what else it does, though, and I think this is an underappreciated part of playing covers, is the fact that it does teach you about arrangements for hit songs.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. When you play those things night after night.
I mean, you should, but, and that's one of the problems, I think, that cover musicians traditionally haven't grasped that enough, about how cool that is, that you're actually pulling apart a song, putting it back together, and finding out what makes it tick in order to make it work on stage. Or at least you should be doing that.
Yeah, you know, Bobby, it all comes down to attitude with everything. Whenever it is you're doing, if you're giving it your full attention, you're paying attention and trying to glean as much from it as you can, that information is there. But if you're showing up with a little bit of an attitude because, hey, man, I really should be a rock star and I'm playing covers and I'm, you know, I wish this other musician in the band was as good as I am. If you bring in a little bit of that into it, you're not going to get all the magic of what you could be getting from the situation. Rumor and I did a little lecture seminar thing at BIM in not Glasgow, up in Dublin a few months back. And so it's all these kids that are at BIM is a music school over in Europe. And that was the main thing I was really trying to get across to them was your attitude, how you approach it, is going to determine everything in your life. Because even if you're playing in some crappy band, even if it's a cover band, or it's something that's not great, if you don't have that much going on, your opportunities are going to come from those 5 or 6 people you're working with right now. Because They're the ones that are going to recommend you or not. And so it really is important that you bring your best, not the wrong attitude, but the right attitude, because that will lead to that. It's funny, we were talking about AMFM. How we met, most of the guys in that band were doing a showcase for a singer-songwriter, one of many who's got her little record out and trying to put together a little showcase band. Song's fairly good, nothing great, but the attitude of all those guys happened to be really fantastic. And while we were doing this little TV show thing down in San Diego is when the concept for that band came up. Man, we really should put a band together and kind of play these songs. And it was fun. And it came from that bringing your best to the situation, because that little situation led to this other thing. And I would say everything in my life anyway has been that when you bring that really good attitude that then people are willing to go stick their neck out for you. Man, I know that guy. He shows up on time. His gear works. He's got a good attitude. Even though we were playing, you know, schmaltzy standards or whatever it was, he's got the right attitude for you. You know, that he'll be good for that. And that's massively, massively important, because we always have to do things that we don't necessarily love. We have to sometimes either engineer or produce or play on sessions of things that really aren't fantastic or aren't our cup of tea, or play in bands that aren't what we're aspiring to. But those are opportunities to not only bring a good attitude and cast your net from a networking point of view, but as you pointed out, that's massively important. Almost every musical situation has opportunity to learn from it and take something away from that. And I think you can't miss those opportunities. And like you said, in a cover band, you're playing some of the best hit material. There's a reason why that stuff has risen to the top, whether it's your cup of tea or not. And it might just be the kick drum, bass drum interaction. That's important is what you need to take away from it. It might be how they chopped those two extra beats and went right to that pre-chorus to keep the flow moving. There's something there, most likely, especially if you're playing over the course of a night of material. There's a lot to be learned there. So take advantage of that, because those things are not only going to inform you intellectually, but it's a good opportunity to condition yourself to just come with an open attitude. And that's the thing that's going to lead to moving your career path forward.
You know, it's when I get asked to, I have a production clinic that I do, and I always start off with, you know, you have to respect the magic of a hit. Even though you might not like the song or the artist or, you know, any number of things about it, it captured some magic. Or else, you know, millions of people wouldn't have listened to it and love it and listen over and over. So you have to respect it even though you don't have to like it.
When you're listening to some of these hits, whether it be an artist you don't like or a genre you don't like or a song you don't like, do you still kind of give it a listen and try to figure out what it is that connected?
Yeah, and actually it's detrimentally so, I think. Sometimes, you know, I don't listen for fun as much as I'd like, and I tend to analyze things and listen through the song, and you know, you're thinking, well, I'm thinking, why do they use that delay there, and oh, that's an interesting reverb, and oh, that's interesting how they, you know, dropped a beat there or whatever. So sometimes it's not pure enjoyment, unfortunately. I wish I can get back to that. How about you?
I think we probably go through phases with that. I think what I've been doing the last few years, and it's happened naturally, and it might be just with a little bit of age now, is that I really connect immediately to what does that make me feel. And I really early on acknowledge what I'm feeling about it. And I think that's important. And I've really gotten the intellectual part of it to kind of happen after the fact. So I might go, wow, that song makes me feel good. It's a Kesha song, but for some reason I dig it, you know?
Yeah.
Even though, you know, maybe there's parts of you that would go, well, why would you like a Kesha song? I don't know, man. That kind of makes me feel good. There's something cool about it. And then I can kind of intellectually unwind about what it is. Or the opposite of like, hey, man, I know that's the biggest hit record on the planet right now, but I don't feel anything from that.
Yeah, yeah.
So at least I like to acknowledge what it makes me feel first.
That's really good advice, Rob.
And then go to the intellectual analyzation of it. I think it's important for us to know when we're feeling something, and actually put that front and center. Because really, at the end of the day, what we are trying to do is get people to feel something.
Yeah.
And so I think that has to start anyway with us being connected to that in ourselves.
What's the thing that you do that's the most fun in music?
I really love getting the frame around a song and the singer and getting that right. I'm not a flash player and was really never interested in that aspect of musicianship. I think it's, again, because of my path. Growing up in Arkansas, I wasn't exposed to heady jazz or anything really young, as you know, rock and blues and country. But at the heart of that was the song. And I think then when my path out in California fell right into the world of song as well, you know, through Motown, Dion Burke. So for me, that's always been where it's at. And when you really can get the right frame around a song and a singer together, I just love that. It's a thrill I still get. And as we've talked about over the course of our chat, sometimes that means dumping stuff out. It means thinning things down. It means getting rid of some ideas, not too precious, so that you can do that. But for me, when that all comes together, I really love it. And not just in the recording element, I get the benefit of usually getting to see these things performed in front of an audience. And when you see that translate, not only like, oh, I made a nice recording, and wow, people out in the audience are singing the words to that as well. That's a thrill, because you've put across a message, and you put across an emotion, and nothing beats that.
Yeah. I get it. So Rob, tell me about your solo record.
The solo record. It's mostly instrumental. It's sort of film theme based. Piano with some orchestra. Orchestra will be live. One of the things I haven't decided 100% this is the way it's going to go, because I've just finished the compositions on it. But rather than go to one studio and getting a really nice piano and all mic'd up, as great as that is, that's still only one sound. And as all these sample libraries, you know, have shown us, there are a bunch of different approaches to drums or orchestra or pianos even. So I think I might go the route of using a handful of the sample libraries for the piano parts, not so I can cheat on the editing playing side, because I'm a player, but I like the fact that you can easily move between sounds, either between pieces or maybe even within a piece. So I really, that would give me the flexibility of starting a piece where the piano is exposed on its own with one sound, and then off to the side, a different piano comes in, even though there's still continuity in it. I'm a bit enamored with the thought of approaching it that way. Now, if the piano libraries are going to hold up performance-wise to be able to be as intimate and controlled as I need, it kind of has yet to be discovered. So I'm at that point right now, because it would be very time-consuming and costly to tramps around to half a dozen different studios and 12 different pianos to recreate that on my own. I just don't really have the time or the money to do it that way. So I'm curious about doing it this way. That being said, even if I do that with the pianos, the orchestras most certainly will be live, and I'll do that out of Los Angeles, probably at Capitol, with a really great string section, and then have a little bit of extra bass here. A couple of things might have a little rhythm section on it, but for the most part, the music, from a musical point of view, it's about themes, and themes that would be for maybe like a movie that doesn't exist is kind of the premise of it. But that's how I tend to compose when I'm writing on my own. I've got a new publishing deal with Downtown, and they've been really great creating opportunities for this. So I think as I'm getting older, probably heading a little more towards film and television, and for me to start would be getting my first at least solo CD out there with some of those piano-only compositions. And then go from there.
Sounds very cool. What's the ETA?
I'm hoping to have pianos recorded in the next, I don't say 2 to 3 weeks. I think there's one more piece that needs to be written, and then start the orchestrations. I'm starting a new rumor record as well, and so these are kind of overlapping with a little bit of touring with Dion. So there's just a lot going on. So, but I'm hoping to do string dates by mid-September, and then the new rumor record needs to be done by the end of the year. So it's kind of a busy back half of this year, but the record, most certainly my solo record, should be out by the end of the year.
Well, it's good to be busy. It's the only thing I can say. It's better than the alternatives. Last question. What's the best piece of music advice that you either learned through the course of your career or someone imparted to you?
The best piece of advice I ever got, I think, was from Bert, and it was dress in layers. Because no matter how hot it is outside, the air conditioner could be blasting. No matter how cold it is outside, the heat might be blasting. Dress in layers.
It's so true, though. It's so simple yet so true. I love it. Oh, that's great. Rob, thanks so much for your time today. This is great. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Bobby. Love chatting with you anytime.
Likewise. You can find out more about Rob and his website at robschrock.com. That's Rob Schrock, like rock with an SH in front of it. All one word, robschrock.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, Go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOinnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter or alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.